It's half past 8.
It's 8:30 New York time. Time to wake up America and stump the experts. Every week at this time, Lucky Strike puts on a coast-to-coast quiz party. For every question we use, Lucky Strike pays out $10 plus a copy of the new Information Please quiz book. If your question stumps us, you get $25 more, plus a 24-volume set of the current Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of duplication, Information Please uses the question that was received first, and all questions become the property of Information Please. And now light up a lucky strike as I present our master of ceremonies, the literary critic of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, spontaneous as ever, Information Please continues on its carefree path. And tonight, our experts are John Kieran, sports expert and naturalist, author of John Kieran's Nature Notes, Franklin P. Adams, light verse writer and conductor of the Conning Tower in the New York Post, Rex Stout, creator of the Nero Wolfe Mysteries, and Chief Magistrate Henry Curran, whose autobiography, Pillar to Post, was published recently. Now remember, for each question that's missed, Lucky Strike rings up $25. And that's paid out to the sender, plus 24 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. We'll start the proceedings this evening with a question from Mrs. Robert E. Dixon of Fort Washington, New York, that will send all of you gentlemen scurrying back to your childhood, if any. In what game would you be playing if you called out the following phrases? There are four of them, and you have to get all. Suppose you called out, "Ready or not, here I come." What would you be playing? I have one, two, three hands. Mr. Stout.
Pum, pum, pull away.
Never heard of it.
Hide and seek, then.
Hide and seek. Pom pom pull away, the Latin?
No, that's the Kansas for it.
Is that what they call it in the Middle West? Stout didn't know that. What were you going to say, Mr. Adams?
I was going to say I spy or hide and seek.
Yes, that would be quite right, and I would understand every word of it. Now, suppose you said, "Come over, come over." What would you be playing? Come over, come over. Judge Curran.
Prisoner's base.
Prisoner's base. Is there another name for that? I used to play a game which rhymed with come over, come over. I don't know whether that would be the same as prisoner's base or not. Mr. Kieran, what were you going to say?
I was going to say prisoner's base.
That's two for prisoner's base. What were you going to say, Mr. Stout?
Something about rover because it rhymes.
That's right. Rover is right. And what color?
Red.
Red.
Red. Well, is that the same as prisoner's base?
Well, that was our style anyhow.
I think I'll accept either answer. Yeah. Judge, you're pretty certain of this.
Oh, absolutely sure.
Well, we never contradict the court here. Suppose you said, "Heavy, heavy hangs over thy head." What would you be playing? Heavy, heavy hangs over thy head. Mr. Adams.
Forfeits.
Forfeits, yes. Very good. Is there another name for that in the Midwest, Mr. Stout?
I know how it goes. Heavy, heavy hangs over thy head. Fine or superfine, what shall the owner do to redeem it?
What a memory.
Used to call it lead man.
Very good. In the Midwest, I think they do call it fine or superfine. Yeah. What were you saying, Mr. Adams? I'm sorry.
Lead man, we called it.
Good enough. I had no idea there were so many names. Now, suppose you called out beaver. What would you be playing? Beaver. Mr. Kieran.
You'd be playing beaver.
A game, how does it go?
Spotting beards,
Spotting beards, yes.
Is that necessary, Mr. Fadiman, on this program?
Well, it isn't obligatory on this program. We could have a little game of beaver here, I should say, for the benefit of the audience, because Mr. Stout is sporting his regular perennial beard this evening. And I've never known it to look in better condition, Mr.
Thank
Stout.
Thank you.
It's been a good spring for it.
Spring cleaning so early?
Yeah.
That gives us 4 out of 4. And sends us on to a question for Mrs. Dorothy K. Risberg of New York City. Identify these literary felines. A feline, Mr. Adams, is what?
A catty.
Yes, a cat. Get all on this. Now, the first one is Felix. Who is Felix? A literary feline named Felix. Mr. Adams.
I think that's the cat in Pinocchio.
No, I don't think it is, Mr. Adams. Though I've
Felix
forgotten...
the cat.
That's correct, Felix the cat. You've got 90% of it already. Well, who is Felix the cat? Where does Felix the cat hang out? Mr. Stout? It's the comic strip cat that is to be found in the Journal American.
With Ignatz.
And other papers. That's right, Mr. Kieran. I'm afraid we have to count that wrong. Would
the crazy
say that?
Cat?
No, it's Felix the cat. Oh, no, I don't
a happy
think...
cat.
It's a different one. How about Hamilcar? Hamilcar, H-A-M-I-L-C-A-R, a famous literary cat. Whereabouts?
In what book, gentlemen? That is a tough one. In a delightful book by the French writer Anatole France, a book called The Crime of Sylvestre Bonnard, right. You'll find, Mr. Kieran...
Yes, I know it.
I knew you knew it. There was a look of half-intelligence on your face. You'll find Hamilcar the cat as one of the major characters.
Let's try dogs.
Sorry, have to stick to cats. How about Mehitabel? Judge Curran.
Mehitabel was Archie's false friend.
Archie's false friend, that's well put. And who is the creator of Archie and
Mehitabel? Don Marquis.
Don Marquis, the late Don Marquis. That's quite right, Judge Curran. And you will seem to be the only one that knows your cats this evening. Well, that will send $25 and a set of the Britannica to Mrs. Risberg. Courtesy of Lucky Strike. Now, how about this one? From Kenneth B. Amer of this city. Get all on this, gentlemen. It's a military and naval question. I believe all of you served either in the Army or in the Navy at one time. Am I right or wrong? Judge, you have, I believe, served in...
I was in the Army.
You were in the Army. And Mr. Stout, you were in the Navy?
Navy.
And I know... But if you were a private in the Army or a sailor in the Navy, how would you address each of these officers? The first officer is Major West, an Army chaplain. What would you call him? Judge.
Sir.
Yes, but I meant... of course you would call him sir, but I meant a more formal mode of address. Mr. Kieran.
Well, we call him Padre in the Army.
No, that's an informal mode of address.
Major.
Well, you'd give him his full name, though, wouldn't you?
Major West.
You say Major West. Yes, that's what I'm trying to drag out of you, Mr. Kieran. Suppose it was Lieutenant Jones, a doctor in the Navy. What would you call him? You're a doctor in the Navy, Lieutenant Jones. What would you call him? Judge.
Lieutenant.
Go ahead.
Lieutenant.
No, that would be wrong. That would be wrong. Mr. Doc. Adams, what were you going to say?
Lieutenant Jones.
No, that would be wrong, too, Mr. Kieran.
Doc.
That would be... I don't think you'd stay long, Mr. Stout, if you did. Dr. Jones. You'd say Dr. Jones if you were a doctor in the Navy. That gives us two wrong. Now, suppose... the case were Lieutenant Commander Smith in the Navy. What would you call him? Mr. Kieran.
Commander.
Now, that's wrong, too.
Well, who says so?
What
would you call him?
Well, I know what I'd call him. I have it down here on
Mister,
the
card. Mister, I suppose.
That's right. Mr. Smith.
An enlisted man calls him a mister?
Mm-hmm. Am I wrong again?
I never served in the Navy, but I've always heard them called Commander rather casually. I believe the officers address one another as Mr., but I
You don't think an enlisted man would do that?
I thought an enlisted man calls a superior officer by his rank.
Mr. Stout, how about that?
Not when I was in the Navy about a century ago. It was Mr.
Mr.
Why didn't you speak up?
I didn't think they were still doing it the same way.
No, things haven't changed. Now, suppose it were Captain Brown, a doctor in the Army. Then what would you call him? Mr. Adams.
Captain Brown.
That's good, Mr. Adams. You are very good at this. Why haven't you had your hand up before?
Because this was in the Army, and I knew a lot of doctors who were colonels. And we called them colonel.
You got me all mixed up by this time. Well, that gives us one out of four, which is just enough to send $25 and a set of the Britannica to Mr. Amer, courtesy of Lucky Strike. Now we're going to get two out of three on this and see what you can do with it. It comes from Ruth Candy of Northampton, Massachusetts. Identify from the quotations that I'm going to give you the following judges of fiction, judges that you find in novels or plays or poetry. Here's the first bit of identification. All you could see of him was two queer little eyes, one broad pink face, and somewhere about half of a big and very comical wig. Judge Curran.
Is that the judge in the Widow Bardell's trial?
That's right. I see you know your judicial literature. That's quite right, Judge. Where is the trial to be found? In what book? Mr. Adams?
Pickwick Papers.
In Pickwick Papers, yes. Well, the judge gets perfect credit for that, and thank you for the little assist, Mr. Adams. Now, how about this one? But the lawyers smiled that afternoon when he hummed in court an old love tune. What judge? Mr. Kieran.
The judge went by Maud Muller's friend, who went away.
That's right. Maud Muller's friend who went away. And you're referring to a poem by whom?
Bryant.
I think not.
Whittier.
Longfellow.
Whittier.
Thanks, said the judge.
You mustn't... That's right. You mustn't get those bearded fellows mixed up.
He was a Quaker poet. Don't deprive the Quakers of
that. That's right. He was a Quaker poet. Now, how about this one? Quote, though all my law be fudge, yet I'll never, never budge, but I'll live and die a judge.
And a good judge, too.
Did you write this, Mr. Adams?
No, but Mr. Gilbert did.
And it's to be found where?
Trial by jury.
In trial by jury. And that gives us 3 out of 3 and sends us on to a question from Mrs. Marshall Butt of Portsmouth, Virginia. You get 3 out of 4 on this. This is a geographical question. What bodies of water does each of these connect? The first is the Panama Canal. And don't tell me the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, gentlemen, because that's not sufficiently specific. What bodies of water does the Panama Canal connect? Mr. Kieran?
Well, the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, I think you can be even more specific than that. Mr. Adams?
It probably connects the Caribbean Sea.
You're all right so far.
And maybe the Gulf of California.
No, not the Gulf of California.
Lower California.
No. No any more gulfs? Why don't you play it?
Gulf of Panama.
Gulf of Panama, Mr. Kieran. That was you.
Yes,
saying
it was.
Gulf of Panama. I'm going to give you boys full credit for that. Gulf of Panama and the Caribbean Sea. How about the Dardanelles? The Dardanelles, Mr. Stout.
The Black Sea on one side and you could say the Aegean Sea or the... Yes, you'd have to say Aegean, I suppose. You could say Mediterranean, but the Aegean's a part of the Mediterranean.
The Aegean Sea on one side and not the Black Sea. Or at least you could be more specific.
Well, the Strait of Marmora.
That's it, the Sea of Marmora.
Is between it and the Black Sea, that's right.
Why didn't you say that?
Well, you mean any body of water, no matter how small.
Oh, it's a nice, well, a little body of water, the exact little body of water.
Make it Marmora.
That's right, the Bosporus is on the east side of that Sea of Marmora.
I can see it as clear as if it were daylight, Mr. Kieran. How about the Suez Canal? The Suez Canal connects what bodies of water, Judge Curran?
The Red Sea and the Mediterranean.
The Mediterranean and... Not the Red Sea, but...
Sea of Aden.
Gulf of Aden.
The Gulf of something or other, but what?
Gulf of Suez.
That's right, the Gulf of Suez. Have to milk this out of you, boys. The Mediterranean Sea and the Gulf of Suez. How about the East River? Judge Curran, you've been around the East River the other day. Connects what bodies of water?
The Upper Bay and the Harlem River. And on the other fork, the Sound.
Yes, and Long Island Sound. That's right. Now, how about this one? From Betty Reich of Milwaukee. I'm going to ask you to give me 4 titles of books or plays that contain the names of articles that are frequently carried in a woman's handbag. I don't know whether any of you gentlemen have ever lived in a woman's handbag for any length of time, but if you have, you know they carry an astonishing assortment of articles. Can you give me titles of books or plays mentioning those?
Mr. Seven Scott. Keys to Bald Pate.
Very good. 7 Keys to Bald Pate. Yes, they do contain keys. That's right. Judge Curran.
Black Beauty.
Wait a minute now. Got me all mixed up. Black Beauty, you mean they carry beauties around in a purse? You see, you have to name...
Mascara is Black Beauty.
I beg your pardon? Oh, you boys are too much for me. Too much for me. Any other suggestions, gentlemen? Now, just imagine the interior of a woman's purse. Close your eyes. Mr. Kieran.
Well, the ring and the book. Some of them carry little books in there, and once in a while you might find a ring.
Yes,
I'd never look.
That's reasonable. Yes, Judge.
Alice in the Looking Glass.
That's a very good one. They do carry mirrors. Alice through the Looking Glass. That's very good. I think we have 4 now. Let's get 1 or 2 more. Yes, Mr. Kieran.
Hard Cash.
Hard Cash. Who wrote Hard Cash?
Charles Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Adams. That's right. Hard Cash. 3 Black Pennies.
Very Hard Cash.
By Hargesheimer. There's a novel by Thackeray, Mr. Kieran, one of your favorite novels.
Vanity Fair.
Vanity Fair, Mr. Adams. That's right. Very good. Tobacco Road would be another. Mention a whole crowd of them. Ellery Queen, Mr. Stout, one of your competitors, once wrote a book called what? The Powder Puff Mystery. Powder Puff Mystery, that would do equally well. Well, let's see. So far, Lucky Strike seems to have paid out the sum of $50 and 2 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, Mr. Cross, here's a question about Lucky's that turned up in our mail. How can the American Tobacco Company afford to pay so much more than the average market price for tobacco?
Well, Mr. Fadiman, the answer is simply this. It's good business. Buying tobacco is like buying anything else. You get what you pay for. If you pay higher prices, you get better tobacco. If you get better tobacco, you can make better cigarettes, and more people will want to smoke them. Let me give you a concrete example of how we get the finer, lighter, milder tobaccos for Lucky's. At auctions in Mount Pleasant, Tennessee last season, American paid 21% more per pound for the tobacco it bought for its cigarettes and other tobacco products. Yes, 21% above the average market price paid for all the various types and grades of tobacco sold there. And the best we bought will go to Lucky's. So it goes at market after market. We pay the price to get the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder tobaccos for Lucky's. That's good business for us, because it's good smoking for you.
Mr. Cross, that's making it short and sweet in just 58 seconds by my watch. And before we go on with the next question, I'd like to take this opportunity of expressing our appreciation for the recent honors bestowed upon Information Please. In the Star of Stars poll, conducted by Movie Radio Guide magazine, Information Please won the national awards for the best quiz show and the best educational program. Well, it's very nice to be told by our listeners that we're as good as all that, and we're going to do our best to live up to it. And our best thanks for this beautiful trophy, which we will add to our collection with the greatest satisfaction. Now, remember, gentlemen, we are the best quiz program and the best educational program. Be on your mettle for the rest of the evening. Here's a question
from... If you're best, you can't make it better, Mr. Fadiman.
No, but you can make it worse. Here's one from J.B. Harden of Newton Center, Massachusetts. Get 3 out of 4. Several years ago, these animals that I'm going to describe were familiar to us on billboards. What product was, or perhaps still is, advertised by each? Now, the first is a white dog squatted on his haunches. Oh, we have several hands. Mr. Adams?
His master's voice, or the Victor talking machine.
Yes, that would be quite right. We had 4 hands raised on that. Everybody knew the answer. Now, the second animal is a kitten playing with a spool of thread. What product is being advertised? Mr. Adams, get.
Corticelli silk.
Corticelli silk. Very good, Mr. Adams. Now, the third is simply a parrot. A parrot. What product? Mr. Stout.
A kind of handkerchief.
Yes, you may name it.
I think I forget the name of it.
That's right.
Yeah, seal packet.
Seal packetchief. Very good. Seal packetchief, a kind of handkerchief. And the fourth, a fish hanging over a man's shoulder. Mr. Kieran?
Scott's emulsion, I believe it
yes,
is.
Yes, and don't tell us the plot. That's right. That gives us 4 out of 4. Had 4 hands on that, by the way. How about this one, which is a somewhat harder question, I think. Get 2 out of 3. This was thought up by Mrs. E.F. Wells of Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's about death summonses. I don't know, Judge, whether you're familiar with that kind of summons in your work. To whom did a death summons come in the following manner? To whom did a death summons come through an invitation to a walk? A death summons that came through an invitation to a walk. Mr. Curran.
The oysters.
That's very good. Will you explain?
By the walrus and the carpenter. Will you take a walk with us? And they ate them, every one.
That's very good, Mr. Kieran. And I think that's a pretty tricky question. I think I'll give you this trophy, Mr. Kieran. Mr. Adams, did you think that was hard?
Not at all.
You knew the answer?
Yes.
All right.
Any child would know that.
There's a compliment for you, Mr. Kieran. To whom did a death summons come in the form of an ace of spades? A death summons, Mr. Stout.
Any member of the suicide club.
That's exactly right.
Who happened to get it.
What is the suicide club?
It's a story by Robert Louis Stevenson.
That's right. And what was the purpose of the suicide club?
I forget specifically, but it seems generally to get everybody killed off.
Yes, they did it themselves.
Yeah.
And as soon as they got the ace of spades, they knew they were the ones selected to cut his own throat.
He had to kill himself within, I think, 24 hours.
Yes, it's like sort of putting the card before the hearse, so to speak, Mr. Starr. And now how about a death summons coming as a proposal of marriage? Death summons coming as a proposal of marriage. Mr. Kieran.
Bluebeard's wives.
Sure, yeah. Well-known lady killer, that's right. Any of Bluebeard's wives would have gotten her death through a proposal of marriage. So that gives us 3 out of 3. Here's a more serious question, gentlemen, from William H. Russell of Baltimore. There were 5 cabinet officers in our history who eventually became chief justices. Can you name 3 of them, or all 5, if possible? Judge, will you start us off?
John Jay.
John Jay. What was he in the cabinet before he became chief justice?
Well, he was Secretary of the Treasury.
No, of State. Secretary of State.
Right.
Under which president?
Washington.
Under Washington. That's quite right, Judge. Now, how about another one? Mr. Stout?
Salmon P. Chase.
Salmon P. Chase.
Cabinet Secretary of the Treasury, and Lincoln made him Chief Justice.
That's exactly right. That gives us two out of the five. Judge Curran.
Charles Evans Hughes.
Charles Evans Hughes is right. What position did he occupy?
He was Secretary of State.
Yes, and what administration?
President Coolidge.
Yes, also under Harding, I believe. Mr. Adams?
Yes.
William Howard Taft.
William Howard Taft. What cabinet office did he occupy?
Secretary of War.
Yes, and under what president? Judge Curran?
President Roosevelt.
Yes, Theodore Roosevelt, appointed, however, by Harding. There's one more that we haven't named. A very famous Chief Justice, John Marshall. Or did we name him?
Oh, what happened?
John
him?
Marshall. He was Secretary of State under John Adams.
Oh, yeah.
And he was appointed by John Adams. That gives us five. C.R. Roberts of Monroe, Louisiana, sent this one in. Get two out of three. What did the poet have in mind when he penned these lines that I'm now going to read? The first is very easy, I think. I'd rather see than be one. What did he have in mind? Mr. Stout.
Purple cow.
Purple cow. Who wrote the line?
Gillette Burgess.
Yes, and it's been haunting him ever since.
I've never seen a purple cow. I never hope to be one, but this I'll tell you anyhow. I'd rather be than see than be.
Yes, you've got your B's and C's.
Let me go it over.
You don't know your A, B's, and C's, Mr. Stout. That's approximately it. Now, here's another line. What did the poet have in mind with this line? I'll hold her nozzle agin the bank. Judge Curran.
Jim Bledsoe.
That's the poem, all right. And what was the object that he was talking about? Yes?
To run her in so that the passengers could go ashore.
Yes, it was a boat that he had in
mind. The Prairie Belle.
The Prairie Belle. Mr. Adams, what's the story of... What's the plot of the poem? Do you remember?
I don't remember anything about it. I know that John Hay wrote it.
John Hay did write it, and Judge Curran probably remembers it.
Bledsoe gave his own life. And
there
was a beautiful ending about a particular place in heaven for him, although he was a roughneck compared to all the high hat people.
That's right. And I want you to remember that, Mr. Adams. Now, what did the poet have in mind when he said, how beautiful they stand amidst their tall ancestral trees? Mr. Adams.
The stately homes of England.
Yes, the stately homes of England.
Not Sherlock.
No, not Mr. Stout's... predecessor. Who wrote the poem?
Felicia Hemans.
Very good, Mr. Adams. That gives us three out of three. I think that's pretty good going.
I didn't think I knew
you
that.
Like that? Things kind of up your alley this evening, Mr. Adams, aren't they?
I have no alley.
Here's one from Raina Cooper of New Haven. Here's a hypothetical situation, gentlemen. If Judge Landis, the High Commissioner of Baseball, should resign, and the major league teams were divided upon his successor, who would be able to cast the deciding vote? Mr. Kieran, have you ever thought of that in the course of your experience as a sports writer?
No, I haven't.
What do you suppose would happen? Any idea? Who would cast the deciding vote? Well, how about a guess, gentlemen?
Babe Ruth.
Judge Landis.
The judge would not be able to have any say, I think, about his success. I don't think that would be quite right. What were you going to say?
The deciding vote?
Yes, then? The deciding vote.
President of the National League.
Gee, I wish you'd stopped after president. The President of the United States, Mr. Adams.
He's too busy already.
Well, you think so. No, those are the official baseball rules, Mr. Kieran. You don't mean to say that I can teach you something about
baseball, right. This
evening. That's... In the event of failure to elect a successor within 3 months after a vacancy has arisen, either major league may request the President of the United States to designate a commissioner. Which, as you say, just adds to his troubles, Mr. Stout. Well, that sends $25 instead of the Britannica to Miss Cooper, courtesy of Lucky Strike, and shoots us on to another question coming from Ruth Malloy of Philadelphia. This is about gifts, famous gifts of fiction or fact. Get two out of three. Who gave these gifts? And to whom? Who gave a brass knob from the top of an andiron? A brass knob from the top of an andiron. Any ideas at all? It's a tough one. Really is tough. Well, it's from a book that all of us have read and love. It's Tom Sawyer presenting Becky Thatcher with a brass knob. He calls it his chiefest jewel. Does that come back to any of you now? Doesn't? Reread the book. You'll find it there. That gives us one wrong. How about this one? Who gave a thimble to someone? Mr. Stout.
No, I'm wrong. She tossed something. I have my mind still on Tom Sawyer. I think she gave him a thimble.
That.
when she tossed that thing in his lap to see whether he was a boy or a girl, but let's just forget
that. That's a different one. Yes, I know that, but that's what I
meant. It's a symbol in Alice in Wonderland. It's a gift.
Who gives it to whom?
Oh, Alice gives it to the queen or somebody.
You sure?
No.
Oh, boy, he's not sure. I think I have to count it wrong.
Symbol Simon.
No, it comes from Peter Pan. Wendy in Peter Pan offers Peter a kiss. This is going to slay you, boys. And when he holds out his hand, expecting a tangible gift, she gives him a thimble.
What was he supposed to do with it?
I don't know what he was supposed to do with it. But at any rate, that's wrong. Now, who, in fact or fiction, gave away a birthday? A birthday. Mr. Stout.
Robert Louis Stevenson gave his birthday away. He got a letter from a girl at that time. She's 89 years old now, I think. Who, she didn't have a birthday because she was born on, I think it was February 29th.
That's what you'd think. No, she was born on Christmas.
On Christmas Day,
that's
right.
She got only one set of
presents. He gave her his.
He gave her his birthday, yes. And by the way, if she doesn't celebrate it appropriately, do you know to whom the birthday goes?
No, whom does
it? Never guess.
President of the United
States. That's right. And now here's Mr. Cross with Mr. Speed's influence.
Well, most folks are surprised how much difference there is. One basket of leaf may sell for $10 a 100 pounds, another for $20, still another for $30. It all depends on quality. You've got to pay higher prices to get the lighter, milder leaf, the kind that goes into Lucky's.
Thank you, Mr. Riggs. And, ladies and gentlemen, you'll be interested to know that at 119 different tobacco markets, markets that handle 96% of all the cigarette tobacco sold at auction in this country, the American Tobacco Company last season paid higher prices to get the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder tobacco. For example, at Franklin, Tennessee, American paid 27% more than the market average. At Lawrenceville, Virginia, 32% more. And I could name a full 119 examples. If you're not a lucky smoker now, find out for yourself what finer tobaccos mean to your smoking enjoyment. Find out what makes Lucky Strike the 2-to-1 favorite of independent tobacco experts.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. This evening, Lucky Strike has cheerfully paid out $75 and 3 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Thank you, Mr. Curran and Mr. Stout, for coming to Lucky Strike's party tonight. Next week, Mr. Levant, Mr. Kieran, and Mr. Adams will be aided and abetted by the star of the current Broadway smash hit, Watch on the Rhine, the eminent stage and screen actor, Mr. Paul Lukash. Now remember, for every question we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets $10. And if the question stumps our experts, you not only get $25 more, but in addition, the complete 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your letters with questions and the correct answers to Information, Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. And now, a parting message from Mr. L.A. Speed Riggs, famous tobacco auctioneer of Goldsboro, North Carolina.
And that chant, fully interpreted, ladies and gentlemen, means Luckies pay the price to get the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder tobaccos. With independent tobacco experts, auctioneers, buyers, warehouse men, with men who know tobacco best, it's Luckies 2-to-1.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.